Welcome back, everybody. So we are almost ready to start in earnest with doing quantum field theory on curved space-time and expanding space-times and so on. But we will need still some preparation. So today we will do mostly some mathematical preparations for that task. And we start out with studying functional derivatives because we will need them. And we will talk about the Legendre transform and its role and what it is. And in the process, we will also revisit a little bit the functional Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory, because we can understand it a little bit better once we know more about functional derivatives. OK, so we start with defining what functional derivatives are. And then I give you two examples of how they can be used. One is to make the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation well-defined. If you remember, that was that special lecture where we considered quantum field theory in a Schrödinger picture of time evolution, but also where we did the what would be in first quantization, the position representation of the Schrödinger equation, is in second quantization, the field representation of the Schrödinger equation. In first quantization, the position representation is the representation where the position and momentum operators are represented as multiplication and differentiation operators. And in second quantization, we have that the field operators and the canonically conjugate field operators are represented as multiplication with the field and functional differentiation with respect to the field for the conjugate momentum operators. Okay, so that will be one application of functional derivatives. And then the other one will be to study the functional Legendre transform. We will need the functional Legendre transform later on in order to go from the Hamiltonian framework to the Lagrangian framework, because they are related by Legendre transform. And we will do that not just for one variable that we will Legendre transform, or three of them or something. No, uncountably infinitely many. So it will be a functional Legendre transform. And then I will tell you something about what the Legendre transform really is. The Legendre transform is actually a linearized version of the Fourier transform. And you will see how that comes about. So functional differentiation. Let us start with something very simple, regular differentiation. So that's just the definition of the derivative of a function of some variable u. It's the Newton-Leibniz limit. Now, that definition is easily generalized to the notion of differentiation of functions of countably many variables. So instead of having a function of just one variable and then shifting that one variable by epsilon minus unshifted and then divided by epsilon, limit epsilon going to 0, now let's assume we have a function of many variables. And we label those variables u1, u2, u3, and so on. So in total, we have a whole set of variables. So f depends on a whole bunch of variables. I could have written them u1, u2, u3, u4, etc. But you see, when it's a continuous index, as we will have later on, then I can't enumerate them like that anymore. But then I can still write them with curly brackets as a set and say, this is the index set over which the index runs. So for now, it's countably many variables. So we have a function of countably many variables. And then we can define the derivative with respect to any one of them in the usual way. So the derivative of the function with respect to the ith variable is the Newton-Leibniz limit, just like up here. We take the function, and one of the arguments is shifted by epsilon. And here's the unshifted function. And we take the difference, divide by epsilon, et cetera, et cetera. It's all very easy. The point I want to make is that this can be rewritten like that, where we now have the function, and then every argument is shifted, except that we put here plus epsilon times the Kronecker delta ij, which is just a sneaky way of making sure that we're really only shifting the variable that with respect to which we want to differentiate. Okay, so every variable gets shifted plus epsilon times something, but that's a Kronecker delta. So actually, since we are differentiating with respect to the ith variable, the j runs through all of the index set, and this will peak, will give us a 1, will give us a contribution only in the case of I, so it's actually the same thing as up here. The difference being that this has the generalization now, because we have a Kronecker delta, and then when we have a continuum of variables, then we can write here the continuum of variables plus epsilon times the Dirac delta. So that's just the preparation for that formulation. Uh-oh. There we go. Okay. So now we define differentiation of functions of uncountably many variables in this way. So we have now a function of many variables. Now we don't just have variables u1, u2, u3, but no, the variables are now labeled by a label x, which runs through, let's say, Rn, for example. We can still think of this as being a bunch of variables. You can also think of it as a function, of course, but it's you should think of it as an uncountable set of variables, u, which are labeled by a label x, which is continuous. And then we may want to differentiate our function with respect to one of those variables, u of y. So this function is supposed to do the following. You plug in u of x, and you get out a number. And then when you differentiate df by du of y, you should get something which is a function of y, because it depends on which variable you're, with respect to which variable you are differentiating. So we write it in the usual Newton-Leibniz way, limit epsilon going to 0 of a difference here, divided by epsilon. And here we write down all the variables as we did before, the index running through its index set. And then we have plus epsilon times the Dirac delta, minus the unshifted thing. Let me say a word about terminology. Previously, on the previous slide, this was a f was a function from R into R. This is a function from Rn into Rn, or from R infinity to R. So the output is always a number, but the input here is one variable. The input here is countably many variables. And the input, and so this is a function of one variable. This is a function of countably many variables. And that is a function of uncountably many variables. And such a thing is usually called a functionale. It is, of course, also a function, but in physics it is usual to call maps which take as input a functionale. So this then is a functional derivative. So our f is a functional. It is mapping functions to numbers. So we can plug in into f a u of x, and then we obtain an f of u, which is some real or complex number. And then df by du of x, which we just defined, is what is called a functional derivative. Here's an example. So capital F of u is a functional. We plug in a function u, and then capital F will output a number. Here's a concrete example of that. So we choose a function u of x to plug in there, u. And this functional happens to be such that you need to square the u and then multiply with the cosine integral, integrate over the real line. And out you get a number. Then what would be the functional derivative of this functional with respect to u of y? By the definition above, this is the Newton-Leibniz limit for epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon, and then the difference of the shifted and the unshifted f. So here's the shifted f. The shifted f is when we take f of u, but the u goes into u plus epsilon times Dirac delta. So u goes to u of x plus epsilon Dirac delta. So this is exactly the same function as before, except that it's the same functional as before, except that u of x went into u of x plus epsilon times the Dirac delta, minus the unshifted function. So let's work this out. Here we have a square, and we get these terms. We get u of x squared. We get epsilon times twice u of x Dirac delta. That's the mixed term in this square. And then we get a term proportional to epsilon squared. And it also has a Dirac delta squared in it. And then this term just becomes that one. It's a u of x squared times cosine squared. I just put everything under one integral. And there's a 1 over epsilon in front of everything. And at the end, we will take the limit epsilon going to 0. Now, what is going to survive here? This term cancels that term. And this term will go away. Because even though the Dirac delta squared is ill-defined, can't really square such a distribution, it actually has a prefactor epsilon squared, which means that up here is a factor of epsilon. And for epsilon going to 0, it means that term will drop out. Only term that survives all of this is the term that's linear in epsilon, and that's this one. So we obtain that we can take this limit, get rid of the epsilon, we just get 2 u of x Dirac delta times the cosine and integrate it. The integral, here's what we get. Okay, and then we can carry out that integral to obtain that it is just that. 2 times cosine of y u of y. So overall, here's the answer. Right? So if you take this function, this functional, and you functionally differentiate it with respect to u of y, then it is as if you were ordinarily integrating something, just as if you were naively, differentiating it. So you differentiate it with respect to u, you get a 2 down, and then it's just linear in u, and also you're getting rid of the integral here. That's what happened. Similarly, we can functionally differentiate, for example, such a functional, where we have some f of x, it doesn't have to be the cosine, and then we have u of x to the power of n. And we can already anticipate from how this calculation went, because this is so similar to ordinary differentiation, easy to show that the derivative of this functional gives you that. It's as if you were doing this by hand, you just have to keep in mind that the integral goes away too because of the Dirac delta. So as a general rule, we can remember that functional derivatives act on polynomials in functionals in such a way that we reduce the power as we are used to from differentiating polynomials, and the derivative and the integral goes away. Now, we worked here with functions written as u of x. Now, we could also Fourier transform this. So if we have the same information, it would be quantum mechanically the same state if we worked in the Fourier domain. We could do the same thing and then functionally differentiate. Functional differentiation is a linear operation. And so that's fine. Now, we would also obtain the functional derivative goes through the same way if we used any other continuous basis, such as the Fourier basis, or we could also use a discrete basis in L2. You know, the space of square integrable functions doesn't just have continuous basis, such as the position basis or momentum basis. But we can span the space of square integrable functions also using, for example, Hermite functions, the eigenfunctions of the harmonic oscillator. And there are many other orthogonal sets of functions that can be used to span the Hilbert space of square integrable functions. In fact, whenever you have any Hamiltonian, self-adjoint, its eigenbasis is going to span the space. In particular, it can be completely discrete, as in the case of the harmonic oscillator, in which case functional differentiation actually reduces to ordinary differentiation of just discrete variables. So functional differentiation is nothing qualitatively new. You can just do a change of basis and then go back to the continuous basis.
The basis we have used so far was the Dirac delta basis, right?
The position basis, yes. Yes, in which the Kronecker delta became the Dirac delta. That's right.
But the results that we obtained are independent of
that. Are independent of that, yeah, that's right. Yes. Okay, so functional differentiation is up to a change of basis in the function space, the same as the usual differentiation. Okay, so first example application of functional differentiation. If you remember, we looked at the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory. And we can now make this better defined. So let me remind you of the Schrödinger formulation of quantum field theory. And I will always compare the quantum mechanical case that you're very familiar with the quantum field theoretical case. So in quantum mechanics, we have position and momentum variables. They are labeled by some label J, which, for example, for one particle runs just from 1 to 3. And we have the time variable, time parameter. In quantum field theory, we have the field operators, phi hat of x and pi hat of x, which in the Schrödinger picture do not depend on time, so that these are really just spatial degrees of freedom. So we have self-adjoint operators and uncountably many of them. For every x, for every three vector x, we have another observable here. Just like in quantum mechanics, we have for every discrete value of j within the index set, another position operator or another momentum operator here too. At every position, we have a field operator and a canonically conjugate field operator. And again, we have a time parameter. The Hamiltonian, in the case of first quantization, in the case of quantum mechanics, is typically of the form of a kinetic term p squared over 2m, I omitted the m here, plus some potential. And the potential is usually some function of q and t, but it could also have a p in there. For example, for magnetic fields, there will typically be a p in there. In quantum field theory, a Hamiltonian looks typically of this general form. We have, again, a p squared over 2m term, just again, no m here, just p squared over 2, plus a term that is typically quadratic in phi. Typically something like 1 half phi and then m squared minus the Laplacian and then phi again, plus some potential term similar to this. So that potential term could be, for example, a phi to the fourth power term, as in the case of the Higgs field. Remember that we are working here in the Schrödinger picture, which means that these operators do not depend on time, except if we put some time dependence in there by hand. So we make it a time-dependent self-interaction, for example. So comparing now the first quantized case to the second quantized case, we see that there are the kinetic terms. And then in the first quantized theory, we would say that all the rest, everything that's not kinetic, we would call potential. In quantum field theory, we don't usually do this. This part plays the role of the potential, but then that part is not usually considered, as far as the terminology is concerned, as being part of the potential. Considered part of the kinetic term, even though it has spatial derivatives rather than time derivatives. And that alone would be called the potential. Okay, so then in quantum mechanics, an example of a complete set of commuting self-adjoint observables would be the position operators. In quantum field theory, an example of a complete set of commuting self-adjoint observables, or at least self-adjoint operators, would be the field operators, the collection of all the field operators at all the positions. Then in quantum mechanics, we often use the joint eigenbasis of all the position operators. They can all be simultaneously diagonalized, so we can have a joint eigenbasis. And we can write this in this way. So this is an eigenbasis, this is a vector out of the joint eigenbasis of all the position operators, and it is labeled by the various eigenvalues it has with respect to the various position operators. If there are three position eigenvectors, sorry, if there are three position operators, then each such vector is characterized by the three eigenvalues it has with respect to the x1, x2, and x3 position operator. So, for example, if we take q1 acting on that, then you get the q1 eigenvalue out of this. In quantum field theory, the role of all those many position operators can be played by all those many, uncountably many, field operators. And since they're commuting, in principle, I mean, there are lots of technical subtleties here, but as a matter of principle, we could simultaneously diagonalize all of them. And then we can characterize our states in the same way that we did in quantum mechanics, namely by giving all the eigenvalues that this state has with respect to all of the field operators. So if we take one of those field operators, phi hat of y, at some location, we know this state is going to be an eigenvector to this field operator. It is an eigenvector to all field operators at all y. But if we choose a particular y, we find it's an eigenvector to this operator with a particular eigenvalue that we may write as phi of y. The eigenvalue depends on which operator we choose, so at what y we choose. So we need an entire field, phi of y, to describe the state, to describe the joint eigenstate of all of those field operators. In quantum mechanics, the wave function of an arbitrary state psi of t, remember we are working the Schrödinger picture, distinctly time dependent, is a position in the position eigenbasis, takes this form. We take the abstract state and then calculate the overlap with one of those joint eigenvectors of all position operators, so with a position eigenvector, and then that overlap is the position wave function. You can plug in the positions and then ask what's the probability for finding the particle at these positions. In quantum field theory, we have a wave functional, the kind of thing that we now know how to differentiate. So we have a wave functional of a state. And it is given in this way. We take the abstract state and calculate the overlap with one of those field eigenstates. So to specify a field eigenstate is to specify all the eigenvalues at all the locations y. And that's why this is a functional. You specify all the eigenvalues for all the values y or x in space. So you specify a function, you specify a field, phi of x or phi of y, and that specifies a field eigenstate. And so whenever you specify a field eigenstate by specifying a function, phi of x, you can plug it into here and you get out a number, a probability amplitude for finding the field as having these particular amplitudes. So just like here, you plug in a bunch of positions at the x1, the x2, x3 position, and you find the probability amplitude for the particle being there. Here, you plug in a field configuration, phi of x, and you get the probability amplitude for the field taking on that particular field configuration if you measure it. The notation in quantum mechanics is usually simplified. Instead of writing down this complicated, tedious thing with the set of all variables here with a, you know, a set notation, and here a set notation, we just write it down in a more compact way by saying that in quantum mechanics, we say that we have position wave functions, psi of q, being here the overlap between a position eigenvector and the abstract state. And it is implicitly understood that this Q is a three-component vector. It contains three numbers if it's just one particle, and if it's n particles, it's three n numbers. In quantum field theory, we will just write phi here, and it is to be understood that this means you've specified a function over R3, phi of R3, a phi of x. And that function phi of x is interpreted as this collection of eigenvalues in the joint eigenbasis of all the field operators. And then you get a probability amplitude for finding that. So psi of phi and t gives you the probability amplitude at time t for finding a particular field configuration phi of x. Now we're almost there. In quantum mechanics, we can represent the position and momentum operators obeying these commutation relations in the Q eigenbasis by representing the position operator as multiplication with the position eigenvalue. And we can represent the momentum operator as minus I h bar d by d q d by dqj. In quantum field theory, there is a close analogon to that. There we have that these are our, this is the pair of canonically conjugate variables, and they have these commutation relations. They now act on wave function L. And how? Well, phi hat of x, this operator acts on this wave function L analogously to how the position operator acts on a position wave function. Position operator multiplies the position wave function with the position. And the phi hat operator multiplies the wave function L in the field eigen representation by the field. Just like the position operator multiplies with the position, the field operator multiplies the wave function L with the field. And similar to how the momentum operator is mapping wave position wave functions into the derivative of the position wave function, the canonically conjugate momentum field operators map the wave function L into minus I h bar d by d phi, the functional derivative with respect to phi of the wave function L. And this is proven to be a valid representation in the same way you can prove this. You know, you can just check whether if you first multiply with Q and then differentiate, or first differentiate and then multiply, well, that makes a difference. And the difference is exactly a Kronecker delta, I h bar Kronecker delta. And so similarly here, whether you first multiply with the field phi and then functionally differentiate or the other way around, that too implements the canonical commutation relations, in this case with the Dirac delta, and in that case with the Kronecker delta. So it's all pretty straightforward. So then we can write down the Schrödinger equation. So in quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation takes this very familiar form here. And we need to solve that Schrödinger equation, remember, for all q, right? We want to know what the wave function is for all x, I mean, for all positions, right? So this is to be solved for all t, for all time, hopefully. But also, we'd like to know what is psi of x and t, for all x, for all t. Now, in quantum field theory, the Schrödinger equation takes this form. It's I h bar d by dt, and then here's the wave function L that needs to be calculated. Then here we have the Hamiltonian of quantum field theory that we had earlier, except that now the field operator is replaced by multiplication with the field. You see, this is the Hamiltonian acting on the wave function L, right? So it's I h bar d by dt wave function L is equal to Hamiltonian acting on the wave function L. But how does it act on the wave function L? Well, these guys, and also here we have some phis, they just act by multiplying the wave function L. You see, it's just sum these things, integrate them up, and then you just multiply them onto the wave function now. But here in the Hamiltonian, there used to be a pi hat squared. But pi hat, the operator, is represented in the Schrödinger representation as minus I h bar d by d phi. That's why we have two functional derivatives with respect to phi. They have their origin in the pi squared. So the functional Schrödinger equation looks like this. We have an unknown wave functional. That's the thing that we need to calculate, just like the wave function psi of q and t in quantum mechanics. Here we have a wave functional psi of phi and t. And it's supposed to be a functional such that when you time differentiate it, you get the same thing as if you integrate that up and apply these multiplication and differentiation operators on the wave functional. So you see, that's the mathematical problem that then needs to be solved. And if you don't have a potential, that can be done explicitly. But if you have a potential generally, that's much harder to do. Now, why did I make the point that we want to know the answer in quantum mechanics for all q? Like, we want to know the wave function for all positions, right? It's obviously, that's what we want. We want to know the wave function for all positions. Here, what replaces the q is the phi. So that means we would like to know the wave functional for all phi. Right? So we want to know the solution is going to be a functional, which is a map that takes as its input an arbitrary field phi of x, field over three-dimensional space, and the output is going to be a complex number. So if we succeed in solving that problem, we're going to have a wave functional which takes as input arbitrary field configurations, and as output, the probability amplitude for finding that field configuration if we measure. Right, with this in mind, I think you should now be ready to check the calculations that we did, I think, in the second lecture, where we already did some of the wave functional business there. Basically, to solve it for the ground state, for example. Write down what exactly the wave functional is if the quantum field, for example, is in a ground state. See, for every state of the quantum field theory, there's another wave functional, right? Just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, for every state of our non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there's a wave function. And so here too, for every state of the quantum field theory, for every state, there's a wave functional. Right? So for every state of the quantum field theory, there's a different probability distribution for finding field configuration. Okay, let's move on to another application of the functional differentiation technique. And that's the functional Legendre transform. I mentioned already that the Legendre transform, as you will see later, plays a special role. It has its origin in an approximation to the Fourier transform. And as I will show you later in a crash course of just a minute, quantization can be viewed as a Fourier transform. So the Legendre transform is going to be super important. We will need it next for a particular purpose. We will need the Legendre transform because it gets us from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formulation of a theory. And we will need this urgently. The reason is that the Hamiltonian formulation of quantum field theory explicitly doesn't look covariant at all, because it treats space and time very differently. Time is, you know, the parameter with which we evolve, and space is labeling where our operators are sitting. So this is not a covariant thing to do. It's not obvious how, it's not intuitive, how we should go from the Hamiltonian formulation of quantum field theory on Minkowski space to the Hamiltonian formulation of quantum field theory on curved space-time. How can we keep this covariant? And the strategy that we will pursue is that we start with the Hamiltonian formulation on Minkowski space and then turn it into the Lagrangian formulation. The Lagrangian formulation has the advantage that it is explicitly covariant. And then once we have the Lagrangian formulation, we use its covariance to allow curvature. So we allow then space-time to be curved, to be expanding, and all of that. But then we have the Lagrangian formulation. And in the Lagrangian formulation, we don't know yet how to quantize. So once we have it in the Lagrangian formulation, we will Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formulation. The Hamiltonian formulation will look unusual. For example, the canonically conjugate momentum field is not just phi dot. But we will find out systematically why it is what it is, because we go through the detour of doing the Lagrangian fully covariant thing, and then we are forced. We are automatically deriving what pi, the canonically conjugate momentum field, will be, if not phi dot. So that will be our strategy to start out with, and for that purpose we need the Legendre transform. In particular the functional Legendre transform, because we're dealing with quantum fields. So we'll have to address what happens with pi hat equal to phi hat dot. You see, this is a non-trivial question that comes up immediately as we go to general relativity. And we don't even need any curvature for this to become non-trivial. In general relativity, we can choose whichever coordinate system we want. And none of them is preferred. But if we can choose any coordinate system we want, we can, for example, opt to just change our time variable. We can stretch the time axis or shrink the time axis, or sometimes stretch, sometimes shrink it, like a rubber band. And so we can simply go from one time variable to some other time variable. As long as it's an invertible map, you're fine. General relativity allows that. But let us try to get away with just sticking with this in general relativity. What would happen? Well, for example, if we write that pi hat is d by dt of phi hat, well then, let's see, what happens if we go to a new time variable, tau, where tau is some function of t. We just leave space alone. Well, then we would have that pi hat of tau is equal to d by d tau of phi. Can we get away with that? Not really, because if pi hat of tau is the according to the first definition, pi hat of t is given by d by dt of phi. So we have pi hat is d by dt of phi. But if actually, the t is a function of tau, or tau is a function of t, then this is d by d tau of phi, so d by dt of phi is the same as d by d tau of phi, up to an additional factor here, which is the chain rule factor between tau and t. This factor takes into account that we are squeezing or stretching the time axis. So if the time derivative with respect to t cannot be, in general, the time derivative with respect to tau. So it cannot be that the canonical momentum field is, in every coordinate system, simply the time derivative, whatever the time is. Right? It's ambiguous up to that factor here. And then, of course, you can have coordinate systems that are mixing space and time in wild ways. So generally, we just have to solve that problem. We have to find out, in arbitrary coordinate systems, what is pi. So the strategy will be, first of all, we transform to a coordinate-independent Lagrangian formulation that is completely covariant. And then, as we already discussed, we move on in the next point from special to general relativity. And once everything is covariant, and remember that in this case, in the Lagrangian formulation, there is no p. Right? The issue doesn't come up. It's just q and q dot, or phi and phi dot, but there's no pi canonically conjugate variables. So we move from special to general relativity, and then we transform that general relativistic framework using a Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formulation. And then once we are in the Hamiltonian formulation on curved space, then we second quantize that and get the quantum field theory for expanding spacetimes and black holes and all that. So graphically, this is a map of where we are going. We start with special relativity and first quantized theory. So it's just think of classical fields. Then we do a Legendre transform. And the Legendre transform takes us to a completely equivalent description, which is special relativistic, first quantized theory, just the field theory, the Lagrangian formalism. Then we change something. Then I should just say that all of the left column is Hamiltonian formulation, all of the right column is going to be the Lagrangian formulation. So we move from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formalism. This is being this column is great because it's covariant, so it is something that goes very well with general relativity. That formalism, Hamiltonian formalism, goes very well with quantum theory because we have a Hamiltonian and we know how to handle Hamiltonian. And you know, the whole functional analysis. So we know how to quantize on the left-hand side. We know how to make things covariant on the right-hand side. So we move, first of all, from first quantization Hamiltonian, from the first quantized Hamiltonian formulation to the first quantized Lagrangian formulation. Then we allow curvature. So now everything is covariant, but we don't have Hamiltonian. So then we do a Legendre transform back. And then we obtain a general relativistically covariant Hamiltonian formulation, which we can then quantize along similar lines to what we've done before, except that now we are going to carry along curvature. And so we arrive at our goal here, which is quantum field theory in the Hamiltonian formulation, second quantized. But of course, there would also be a way to go directly from the Lagrangian formulation to of the first quantized theory to the Lagrangian formulation second quantized theory. That's the Feynman way. That's to get the Feynman path integral. And I will say a little bit more about this today as well. And we also have a lecture in which I will do this one step. But since almost all calculations in cosmic inflation theory are done using this route, we will spend most of our time using this route. And we will do this in just one lecture towards the end. And then ultimately, these two formalisms are equivalent because they give us the same correlation functions. And correlation functions are all that matters for quantum field theory. There are certain advantages why, in the literature, you will find that most work is done that way. And that's basically because it's easier to identify the vacuum state, easier to identify multiparticle states in that formalism than it is here. OK, so we need the Legendre transform for these two steps. Hamiltonian to Lagrangian, and then down here, the other direction. Yeah?
When we go from quantum mechanics to QFT, the notion of a vacuum state arises. What does it correspond to in quantum mechanics? Of
were you not there in the earlier lectures?
Sorry.
You see, okay. So remember, what we do is we take a quantum field, we decompose it into its mode oscillators, so that for every wave vector there's a harmonic oscillator. And for now, we go with the definition that the vacuum state is the state in which all those harmonic oscillators are in their ground state. But we will later see that things are more subtle. That would, you see, that would mean that the vacuum state is a state of lowest energy. Apparently, it is not. So we'll get to that. OK, so we need the Legendre transform. Let's look into this a little bit more closely. What is the Legendre transform? So here's the standard definition of the Legendre transform. Assume, given a function f of u, let's say it looks like this. Here's u, here's the amplitude f of u. It's a function like that. Then we can define a new variable which is simply the derivative of f. Let's call it w of u. W is the derivative of f. Now I've chosen to plot a function here that looks like this. It's a convex function. It's a function whose derivative is always positive. The advantage of such a function is that if you know the slope, you know where you are on that function. You see, because every slope occurs only once. You see, the slope increases monotonically because the second derivative is positive. So every slope occurs only once. So if I give you the slope, you can find out where I was looking. This is the slope, right? So what I was saying is that if I give you the slope, you can tell which u it is. At which u there is a slope. There's a unique association, slope to value of u. So on one hand, we have the slope as a function of u, and it's just a derivative. But because the function is strictly monotonic, we can actually invert that too and calculate u of w, right? Which means, give me the slope w, I can calculate the position on the axis u. So the Legendre transform is concerned with functions that have that property. The Legendre transform is concerned with functions whose derivative function has an inverse, a compositional inverse. So let's assume that w of u can be inverted to obtain u of w. And that's okay if the function is like this one, it's always positive or always negative. Then we define the Legendre transform of f to be a new function. Let's call it g. And this new function g, we completely start from scratch, right? It's a new function. And it's going to have a variable. And that variable is w, the one that we just defined there. So g is a new function of a new variable, g of w. And so overall, the picture is we start with a function f of u. The Legendre transform gives us a function g of w. And the definition of g of w is w times u of w. Remember, that's the function we just calculated. We calculated the derivative of f that gave us w of u. Then we said, yeah, we can invert that as a matter of principle. At least then we get u of w. And so that's what we put in here. So the whole thing is a function of w. Easy to remember these two terms because it's just the new variable times the old variable, expressed in terms of the new variable, minus the old function f. But the old function f was the function of u, whereas g has to be a function of w. So we simply express u as a function of w. So the right-hand side is completely a function of w. So what we've done is we've mapped the function of u into a function of w. Now, later I want to explain to you, but it's too early to explain that, why this particular form? Where does this come from? And the reason is it is inherited from the Fourier transform. But we will see that later, why that comes about. I remember when I was a student, everybody told me about the Legendre transform, and I was thinking, what? Why? Why this way? Why not another way? Anyway, it's not a mystery. Here's a proposition. The Legendre transform, when done twice, gets you back to where you started. Quite non-trivial thing, if you think about it. So let's do this. Let's just do the Legendre transform one more time. We went from a function f to a function g. The function f had a variable u. The function g had a variable w. Now, we define yet another function. So we do the Legendre transform again. So how do we do that? We take our function, now it's g of w, and we differentiate it. And that's going to be our new variable now, v of w. And then let's calculate, do we know anything about v of w? Well, let's calculate. V of w is d by dw of g of w, right, by definition. But what is g of w? It is, if you remember, new variable times old variable minus the old function. All of these are functions of w. Let's work it out. So we differentiate with respect to w. That term goes away. We just get the u of w. Here we go. And then we also have that the derivative leaves that one, that term the same, but differentiates the u of w. OK, we get the w carried forward. and the derivative of u with respect to w here. And then here we have to differentiate f with respect to w. So we have to differentiate f with respect to u, and then u with respect to w. Now that term is this one, and that df of u by du is actually w. So these two terms go away, and we're just left with u of w, which is to say it's u. So if we Legendre transform the Legendre transform, if we do it twice, the new variable that we get is actually the very first variable that we started out with. So we started with a variable u, then did the Legendre transform, got a variable w, and then we did it again, and then we get the third variable v, but we found out that this v is actually u again, numerically the same number. So what we found is that the Legendre transform, when done twice, gets us from a function f of u to a function g of w to a function h of v that we still have to write down. But we already know that the v is actually u. Just calculated that. So what is h? H is, according to the rules of the Legendre transform, new variable times old variable minus the previous function, g. So what is this? Well, we have v, which is u, times w minus, and then g was new variable then times old variable then minus very old function then. And what we see here is that this is u times w minus u times w, and then minus minus f, so it's f again. So it's the original function again. Okay, so the Legendre transform done twice gets us back to where we started. Let's do a concrete example. Since we're going to do Legendre transforms totally abstractly, it's probably good to have seen them concretely. So let's say we want to Legendre transform a function of three variables, a, b, and c. And let's say this function is, very concretely, a times e to the power bc. And let's say we want to Legendre transform with respect to one of those three variables, let's say b. Then we have to invent a name for the new variable. Let's call it beta. And in the process, we will treat a and c as if they were just fixed numbers. They're just spectators. They're variables that do not, in any particular way, take part in the Legendre transform. They might as well be 7 and 25. So we want to do the Legendre transform with respect to b, while treating a and c as spectator variables. So what we expect is that we map a function f of a, b, and c through the Legendre transform that takes a variable b and replaces it by a new variable beta, so that we get a new function, the Legendre transform function, which still depends on the spectator variables a and c, but now depends on beta. And how? Well, the new variable is a function of a, b, and c. The new variable is the derivative of f with b. And you see, we chose our function wisely. This thing is strictly monotonic in b. So therefore, it's invertible. So what we have is that beta, the new variable, is df by db. And concretely, this is, if you differentiate it with respect to b, you get a c down. So it's ac e to the power bc. OK, so that's the new variable expressed in terms of the old variables. We need to do an inversion now. We need to express b in terms of beta, because the new, the Legendre transform function can depend only on beta, not allowed to depend on b. So we invert that. If you invert that relationship, beta equal to ac e to the power bc, it's not hard to do. You just take the beta, divide it by ac, then take the logarithm and divide by c, and you get b. So you find that b is 1 over c logarithm of beta divided by ac. So the old variable can now be expressed in terms of the new variables. A and c are spectators, and then here's beta. OK, so now we can do the Legendre transform. We take our original function f up here, Legendre transform it into a function g of a beta and c. And that's what it is. G of a beta and c is new variable times the old variable, but the old variable expressed in terms of the new variables, right? So we have B expressed in terms of A beta and C. That's what goes in here. And we have that explicitly as a function. Here it is, this thing, minus the old function, where all occurrences of B have to be replaced by functions of only A beta and C. So we got the Legendre transform. We just have to plug things in. Beta, and then the B is this function here. So we plug in the B, that's this, minus, and then that, which is the old function F, where the B is replaced by what it is in terms of A, beta, and C. We get that. That simplifies a little bit, and here we go. That's the Legendre transform. So you see, it can actually be done explicitly. It's nothing mysterious. It's just like the Fourier transform. We use it often in a formal way, but you actually can do it practically too, and it's not so difficult.
Question?
Yeah?
So the assumption that the function has to be monotonic, is that always true in the case of quantum fields?
Thanks for the question. I just wrote a paper on that. So the situation is, no, it's not true. These conditions do not usually hold. It's actually even worse. It's not just that these functionals that occur in quantum field theory, and we will get to them at the end of the lecture, not only are they not convex or not strictly monotonic, they're not even functions. In the sense that you plug in a field and you get out an infinity. And yet, it is super successful to do the Legendre transform and then make predictions. And, you know, for example, in quantum field theory, as we will discuss later on, there's this thing called the effective action. It is the Legendre transform of the generating series of connected graphs. All of that is super successful. You can make predictions to like 12 digits behind the comma for the lamp shift and the hydrogen atom. So there's something to it, even though analytically, it makes no sense because those conditions are not met. So with some collaborators, David Jackson and Alejandro Morales, we looked into this. And the idea we had is that what we are really Legendre transforming is not functions, but is power series. See, in quantum field theory, everything is expanded in power series. The action is a power series in fields, and then the generating functionals that we also get in quantum field theory, all power series. And instead of thinking of the Legendre transform as mapping functions that have to be strictly monotonic into functions that have to be strictly monotonic, you can think of the Legendre transform instead as mapping power series into power series. And more concretely, as mapping the coefficients of one power series into the coefficients of another power series. You see, that can make sense even when the power series don't sum up to something finite. The power series may have zero radius of convergence. But the only thing that matters for physics, you never measure the entire power series. You always measure just the coefficients. The coefficients tend to be endpoint functions. They tend to be correlators. The kind of thing that they measure at CERN, the coefficients. So we generalize the Legendre transform, therefore, as to be a map from the coefficients of one power series into the coefficients of another power series. And you can show that that's well defined even when the function, when the power series has a finite radius of convergence or even zero radius of convergence. Or it's explicitly a function, it's oscillatory. And you can't invert, right? You can't go from B to beta and so on. You can still do the Legendre transform in those cases. Yeah, the paper appeared last year. Okay, so, but for now we are pretending that there's no problem. Okay, we'll just proceed as if in quantum field theory that problem didn't occur. And just keep in mind that what we showed is that it can be remedied, because if you just don't think of the function as a function but as a power series, then all of this does make sense if you just think of it as mapping coefficients of a power series into the coefficients of the Legendre transform power series. That is a much more robust map than the map from function to function.
This transform doesn't have any linearity properties, does it?
The Legendre transform?
Yeah.
No, the Legendre transform is not linear.
So the mapping of one power series into another is not a, it's not a simple one-to-one.
No, okay. It's not. Yeah, that's why it took us a few years to figure it out. Yes, and we will see later on why the Legendre transform is not linear. It has to do with the particular way that it approximates the Fourier transform. Okay, so now let's look at the case of countably many variables that we want to Legendre transform. Let's say we have a function of a bunch of variables, uj, and we want to Legendre transform that function, and now without spectator variables, now we want to Legendre transform the whole bunch of them, all at once. We could do it one by one, but we can also do Legendre transform all at once. And that's what we will do now. So we introduce new variables. For each of the old variables, we introduce a new variable. So the u of j get replaced by new variables, w of j, which are the derivatives of f with respect to the old variables uj. We assume again that we can invert this because we are still in the old-fashioned picture of these being functions that need to be invertible and so on. So we assume we can invert this to obtain the old variables as functions of the new variables. And then we can define the Legendre transformed function in the usual way, except that we now do multiple Legendre transforms all at once. So we have the Legendre transform function g that now depends only on the new variables w, and it is defined to be the new variables, the sum of the new variables times the old variables, as before, minus the old function. And again, keep in mind that the old variables, the old function, all have to be expressed entirely in terms of the new variables. Like we went from b to beta. Here we have to replace all occurrences of u with occurrences of w. And you can again show that the square of the Legendre transform is the identity. Now we can generalize this to the case of uncountably many variables. So then how do we do that? We start with a functional now. See, it doesn't just take as input a bunch of variables, countably many variables, but uncountably many variables. So u of x, where x runs through a continuous index set. In other words, you plug in a function. But it's easier conceptually to think of it as a bunch of variables labeled by x. Then the Legendre transform will give us a new functional, which depends on these new variables w, again labeled by x. Remember, this is just a label. The x's are the labels for the variables, which are u and w. Right? So for every fixed x, you have a variable u, and it has a new Legendre transform partner, which is the w of that x. We define the new variables. The new variable to u of x is w of x. And it is defined by functionally differentiating our functional. Because remember, it's a functional. You plug in an entire function if you view it as a function. By functionally differentiating the functional with respect to u of x. And again, we assume that we can invert that so that we get u of x and w. X is the label, right, of our variables here. So then we can define the Legendre transformed functional. Namely, it is, as we did always, new variable times old variable summed over the entire index set, but that's now an integral, and then minus the old functional, where again we have to take care that the variables are replaced by their functions of the old variables are replaced by functions of the new variables. So that all of this only depends on w. So we are mapping functional into functional. And one can show that all of this goes through, and we have the fact that the Legendre transform done twice gets you back to where you started. Let's look at classical mechanics for a moment. apply the Legendre transform there. Let's assume that the Hamiltonian is given, H of Q and P is given. Then the Hamiltonian equations are given. You can easily write down then what the Hamiltonian equations are for arbitrary observables, for arbitrary functions F of Q and P. Now, this is, let's say, classical mechanics even, right? So CM stands for classical mechanics. It's actually true also for quantum mechanics, but even for classical mechanics or quantum mechanics, the time evolution of any arbitrary observable is given by, so if F is some observable, some function of Q and P, then the time derivative of that observable is given by the so-called Poisson bracket between F and H, between the observable and the Hamiltonian. Now, all of that is true in quantum mechanics unchanged. In quantum mechanics, the Poisson bracket is represented as a commutator and up to a factor of IH bar, and that is what brings an IH bar over here and a commutator there in quantum mechanics. But in quantum mechanics, if you write your equation of motion in terms of the Poisson bracket, this is exactly still the equation of motion, no IH bar in it. Which is the reason why, in classical mechanics, as in quantum mechanics, you get this exact same equations of motion. There's no IH bar or anything like that in there. Okay, so now we are in classical mechanics here. And in classical mechanics, if we don't want to work with the Poisson brackets, we can work out what the time evolution is for the position and the momentum variables for any system and just go with that. Because once we know how Q and P evolve in time, we can calculate how everything evolves in time. So you probably remember that in classical mechanics, the equation of motion for Q is this, Q dot is equal to dH by dP. Now, in quantum mechanics, that wouldn't make sense because you would have to differentiate with respect to an operator. But in classical mechanics, that makes sense. And that's the equation of motion. And similarly, the equation of motion for the momentum is given by minus dH by dQ. So these are the equations of motion. Now, let's look at what the Legendre transform can do for us. The Legendre transform can take a classical Hamiltonian function of Q and P into a classical Lagrangian. Which variable gets Legendre transform? Well, P gets Legendre transform, and Q is a spectator. Q doesn't do anything, and we don't do anything to Q either. So we start with a function of two variables, Q and P. Q is spectator, P is going to be Legendre transform. And then we end up with a Lagrange function, which depends on Q and B. B being, I just cooked up the name for it, but B is the Legendre transform variable to P. So for example, the classical Hamiltonian might be of this form, P squared over 2 plus some potential V of Q. Then what's the new variable? What's the variable Legendre transform partner to P? Well, as usual for Legendre transform, it's dH by dP. Right? So we take this function and differentiate it with respect to P in order to get the new variable. So B, the new variable that will replace P, is dH by dP. But we know from the equations of motion this is also actually Q. It's Q dot. OK, so usually people will then just say it's Q dot. Yeah, that's true, but initially it's just a new variable. And then we learn that it is Q dot. So then what is the Lagrangian? Well, the Lagrangian is a function of Q and B, which we know is Q dot. It's a function of Q and B, which is new variable times old variable. But the old variable has to be expressed in terms of Q and B. We're assuming that this is invertible here. And then minus the old function, which is the Hamiltonian, where again we have to replace all occurrences of P by P expressed in terms of Q and B, the new variable. So we can also write this, knowing that B is actually Q dot, we can write it as Q dot P, P as a function of Q and Q dot, and then H of Q and P written as a function of Q and Q dot. And that's then our Lagrangian as a function of Q and Q dot. So I give you the proposition that you've probably seen many times and hopefully also proved. If not, please try to prove it. The equations of motion now in the Lagrangian picture take this form. Well, that equation we already had, but also this equation, dl by dq is d by dt, dl by dp. So this is then the Euler-Lagrange equation. So for example, if the Hamiltonian of our classical system is p squared over 2m plus omega squared half q squared, then the Legendre transform gives us 1 half q dot squared minus omega squared half q squared. And we have these two equations of motion here, which we can also express in terms, on the Hamiltonian side, these are the equations of motion. That's the relationship between p and q dot. And this is the equation of motion on the Hamiltonian side. And on the Lagrangian side, we have that minus omega squared q is q double dot, the equation of motion, and then b is q dot. So those two equations become those two equations under Legendre transform. So the overall structure is we have a function that we Legendre transform. This function induces differential equations. And after the Legendre transform, this function induces those equations. So these differential equations are equivalent to those. That's the overall structure of it. Now let's apply this to classical field theory. So we're still not quantizing this. Just classical field theory. We will have to do it for classical field theory first before we can go to general relativity. Because we can't quantize and then jump to quantum field theory. We'll have to do classical theory, classical field theory, put that to general relativity. Then when it's quantized, we Legendre transform back, and then we quantize second. OK, so classical field theory. CFT in the literature often stands for conformal field theory. That's not what we mean here. We just mean classical field theory. So we assume a Hamiltonian, h of phi and pi, is given. And the Hamilton equation for arbitrary observables are given again by f dot is equal to the Poisson bracket between f and h, as always in classical mechanics. If you are not familiar with this and want to know more about it, there are always my lecture notes of quantum theory 2 that you can find on my homepage, where all of this is explained on the first few pages. So the Hamilton equation for arbitrary, Hamilton equations of motion for arbitrary observables is given by the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, where the Poisson bracket between the field and its canonically conjugate field is given by the Dirac delta. The equations of motion that we obtain are that phi dot is dh by d pi, very similar to q dot being equal to dh by dp. And for fields, we have pi dot is equal to minus dh by d phi, very similar to what in quantum mechanics we have, which is that p dot is equal to dh by dq. Now, let's do the Legendre transform for the fields. So we start with the Hamiltonian as a function of the field and its canonically conjugate field. And phi is going to be a spectator variable, or actually it's going to be an infinite set of uncountably infinite set of spectator variables. And here we have an uncountably infinite set of variables pi of x that we all want to Legendre transform into some new variables. And let's say that instead of the pi variables, the pi variables become, after Legendre transform, the rho variables. It's just like when we went from p to what did we call it, beta or something? B, right. And so similarly here, instead of a field pi, we will have, after Legendre transform, the field rho. Okay, let's do it concretely. The Hamiltonian is given by this. It's some kinetic term, pi squared, and then some potential term, v of phi. Then what are the new field variables here? The Legendre transformed version of the pi. Well, it's obtained by taking the original function and functionally differentiating with respect to pi. So dh by d pi, that is going to be our new variables. These are going to be the new variables rho of x and t. from the equations of motion, we know that dh by dpi is actually phi dot. So everything is still very simple, and we have that the new variable can be identified with phi dot. Of course, not so in general relativity, but for now, we still have this. And therefore, Lagrangian takes this form. Lagrangian is a function of rho, phi and rho, but really a function of phi and phi dot because of the equations of motion. And so the Lagrangian can be written then in this way, where we have new variable. The rho is the new variable, so phi dot. New variable times old variable integrated over minus the old function. Where in the old function, we have to replace occurrences of pi with occurrences of phi dot. Yeah, and then the claim is that the equations of motion are equivalent, the Hamiltonian equations of motion are equivalent to these Euler-Lagrange equations. And if you haven't done it yet, please try that. It's an important exercise to show that the Euler-Lagrange equation is equivalent to what we had earlier in the Hamiltonian framework. So for example, the Hamiltonian of a free Klein-Gordon field takes this form, if you remember, and that gives us that that the phi dot is pi, and the other equation of motion is that pi dot is this, the Klein-Gordon equation. And that is the same thing as what you get after the Legendre transform. Namely, this is the Lagrangian here, the Lagrangian formulation. And if you then put in the Euler-Lagrange equation that we had in the previous slide, you obtain the same equation of motion. OK. So now we are basically done, but I wanted to show you as a remark what the business is with this Legendre transform. The Legendre transform comes up all over the place in thermodynamics, and as we saw today, it comes up as a map between Hamiltonians and Lagrangians, and in quantum field theory too, it comes up at a very central location. And I think it might be of interest to see how it comes up there, because it reveals why the Legendre transform should be defined the exact way that it is defined. You know, with the old variable times the new variable minus the old function, etc. So for that purpose, let us look at quantum field theory. And this is anticipating things that we will do in more detail only much later in the course. OK, so first, the statement is that solving a quantum theory is to do a Fourier transform. That's all it is. If you can Fourier transform, you can solve quantum theories. I'll show you in a moment why. Second, the lowest order approximation, the lowest order approximation of the Fourier transform, in some sense lowest order, is the Legendre transform. And if you replace the Fourier transform by the Legendre transform as an approximation, then what do you get? We know that Fourier transform will give you the quantum theory. If you can do a Fourier transform, you can do a quantum theory. What if you drop the Fourier transform and just go with the Legendre transform first order approximation? That's the classical theory. Classical theory that is obtained by Legendre transform, quantum theory is obtained by Fourier transform. So how does that go? It's a pretty fundamental abstract view on what's going on in physics. So as we will see much later in the course, there is a path integral for quantum field theory. And let me just give you the overall structure of it. This is how quantum field theory looks like in Feynman's perspective. You know, the bottom right of this snaky diagram that we had, how we went from Hamiltonian to Lagrangian to Hamiltonian and so on. So path integral formulation of quantum field theory looks like this. You take the action of your theory. And the action is what you get when you take the Lagrangian and integrate it over time. For a field theory, the Lagrangian has already space integrals in it. You do also a time integral. Then the whole thing becomes covariantly just a scalar. So the action is a functional where you put in a field, not just at a point in time, no, you put in the entire field evolution. Okay, so you put a phi of x and t in there, and you get out a number. So you take the action of your theory, such as the Lagrangian of Gordon field, integrate over time. Take the action, that's the function now. So you can plug in a field over here, and you get a number. And in fact, it's going to be a phase, a complex number. And then here, that is a technical trick that I'll tell you about in a moment. But just to observe what it is, you take that same field phi here and integrate it against a function j of x that is called a Schwinger source function. Schwinger introduced this. He had some physical interpretation for it, but the physical interpretation didn't pan out. But the mathematical usefulness is just super great, so everybody is using it as a mathematical tool. You see, Schwinger thought that j of x would represent particle accelerators and particle detectors. But they don't. Just as a mathematical tool, though, they're super useful, the Schwinger source. And you integrate that over all of R4 here. Now, this is a path integral in the sense that it's a functional integral. What this means is that you're supposed to calculate this for all fields phi in a huge function space. Let's say square integrable fields phi. Well, you want them to be differentiable too in principle because the action needs differentiability. But let's not worry about the exact nature of the function space that we want to functionally integrate over. But the idea overall is that you want to integrate over all functions in this function space. For each one of those functions, you evaluate this number and that number. You multiply them and you get a number, complex number. And then you sum them all up. So you go through all fields, for all field configuration, not just field configuration, but field evolutions, phi of x and t, sum over all of them, and then you get a value out of this. Now, it might look daunting. How can this make sense? Actually, there are ways to make sense of this. If you put an infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff, so you put the whole system in a box, you get discretized momenta, and then you put an ultraviolet cutoff, and then your function space actually becomes much more manageable. And you might get a finite dimensional function space. And then you just have to integrate over the coefficients in this function space, and it just ends up to be a lot of integrals of coefficients of functions. That sort of thing is doable. It's not out of the question. The full problem is still unsolved, but we do have very good approximation. Anyway, the point is that if you can work all of that out, you get this expression here. I mean, actually, it's just a function of j, right? I mean, let's forget about how this is called. This is the outcome of that functional integral is a functional of j. It cannot be of phi because we are summing over all phi. Phi is a dummy variable. It's an integration variable. No, it only depends on j. So whatever this thing is, it's going to be a functional of j. You plug in a function j of x, and you get out a number. And it is convenient to write whatever we get, this functional, as e to the power of minus iw of j. In principle, you can always do that as long as you can take logarithms. There's a bit of an ambiguity here in choosing branch cuts for the logarithm. But apart from that, you can always do it. I mean, some people would write this as z of j, but in practice, we need e to the power I w of j. Two things to be said about this. If you can carry out that path integral, in other words, if you can calculate w of j, you're done. You know everything about that quantum field theory. And why? Well, it's because the W of J, and that is something you just have to take my word for at the moment, W of J, when you look at it as a power series in J, the power expanded in J, then the coefficient for the second power of J is the Green's function. It tells you what is the probability in principle for if you excite the field here, that you get an excitation of the field over there. It tells you all about the propagation of particles. And if you take the coefficient in front of the term with the power of 20, then it means that, well, 20 particles collide with another. What's the probability that they collide in a particular way? So all of the interactions of particles are encoded if you know what W of J is. So overall, the problem is to evaluate this path integral. You see, this is how Feynman did quantum field theory. It has nothing to do with Hamiltonians, nothing to do with Hilbert spaces of states at all. It's a completely different way of doing things, and not necessarily convenient for cosmology. That's why we are not going to focus much on it. But I thought it's interesting to show you a perspective, this perspective already a little bit. So the overall message is that if you can work that out, and you can get the W of J, you're done. Because these W of J coefficients in the power series expansion of Taylor expansion of W, these coefficients are pretty much directly what you can measure in accelerator experiments. And that's the second message. This is a Fourier transform. You see that? You see, it's a Fourier transform for infinitely many variables all at once. See, you have, for every x, you have a variable phi. And this is the Fourier transform, because you have a term e to the power of minus I, and then a new Fourier transform variable, j of x times phi of x. Right? So this is just like the product of a lot of Fourier factors, e to the power of ixp or something, right? So all of these are Fourier factors. If, for example, space was discrete, this would not be an integral. If space was discrete, this would be a sum. And a sum of Fourier factors, j times phi, I, j, phi. So in other words, this function is the Fourier transform of that function. Or that functional is the Fourier transform of that functional. So the problem of quantum field theory, in fact of any quantum theory, because every quantum theory can be put into that form, the problem of quantum theory, of solving a quantum theory, can be reformulated as the problem of performing the Fourier transform of e to the power I times the action. If you can Fourier transform that with respect to all of the variables that occur for a field that's uncountably infinitely many, then you obtain your W of J, and that contains in its coefficient, the coefficients of its power series, all the information that you may ever want to know about your quantum field theory. So e to the power I W of J is the Fourier transform of e to the power I of S of phi. Yep.
So the Fourier transform interpretation is crucial upon the fact that we have exponentials in there.
Yes.
Otherwise, it wouldn't
work. Absolutely. Absolutely. So here we have a functional, and here we have all those Fourier factors. Right? We are Fourier transforming with respect to phi of one point times j of that point. We are Fourier transforming with respect to phi of another point and the j of that other point. Right? We have uncountably many variables, phi of x, and they're canonically Fourier paired variables. So overall, we have a Fourier transform from e to the power I times the action into e to the power of I times W. Where this is the desired solution that can be compared with experiment, and that's the action with which we start our theory. So in principle, you need to do the hard work of calculating that Fourier transform. It can be really difficult. But there is an approximation to this, an approximation that's often very good. An approximation where you can take your action S and calculate an approximate W of J from it. And that is the Legendre transform. If you do the Legendre transform of S, you get a W of J, which is almost a Fourier transform. And it's the classical theory. It turns out that the approximation that you get when you do the Legendre transform instead of the Fourier transform is that you don't get the W of J of the quantum theory. No, you get the W of J of the classical theory. OK, let's see how this all comes about. OK, this Fourier transform up here is a very oscillatory integral. It's super oscillatory. The whole thing is oscillatory. And you may remember that when an integral is very oscillatory, it tends to add up to nothing. because, you know, if you get a positive contribution, immediately cancel by a negative contribution. And there is an approximation called the stationary phase approximation for rapidly oscillating integrals. The idea is simply this. Let's see. Maybe this integral here is oscillating like hell, but at some point it may not be oscillating much. Maybe there is a point in this integral where it doesn't oscillate at all, where the phase is stationary. And that phase would contribute the most to that overall path integral, because it is not canceled by anything. So the lowest order approximation to a Fourier transform is obtained, if you're lucky, by finding out that there is one point where this integral is stationary, where the phase is stationary, and then saying, OK, this is the, where the most contribution is accumulated for the integral, and then just dropping all the other stuff. That's a crude approximation, but it's not so bad. So what integral, what part of the integral might be stationary? So the integrand contributes most where it is stationary. Let's look at this. So for this value of phi, you see we are integrating over all phi. But there's going to be a value of phi, there's going to be a field configuration, or a field evolution phi. There's going to be a field evolution phi for which the phase is actually stationary. If we do the functional derivative of this thing with respect to phi, it's actually vanishing. Which means the integrand is stationary. It's not going to be oscillating away. It's not going to have destructive interference all the time. That's going to be the most contribution. So that's what we are after, where we say that e to the power minus I w of j is approximately e to the power of I times the action minus I times this. So it's just that part. I'm just saying it's exactly the integrand without the integral if phi is the field evolution at which the phase is stationary. So let's try this very crude approximation where we say that e to the power minus I w of j is approximately this thing for that phi for which this phase is stationary, which is to say for which d by d phi of the exponent up here, is minus I j phi integral, so where the derivative of with respect to phi of this exponent of s of phi and the integral is vanishing, right? So we're calculating which phi is it? Which phi is it at which this phase up here is stationary, at which the functional derivative of this phase up here, of this term up here, with respect to phi is vanishing? So do you see the Legendre transform emerging already? OK. You see what's happening is we define now an approximate w. If we say this is approximately, right? We define now the approximate w of j to be equal to the integral of j phi minus s. So it's just exactly this. I'm saying that this is equal to that by definition. The approximate w is equal to this, where phi has to obey that condition here, right? So it has to obey that this thing differentiated with respect to phi is 0. But what does that mean? It means that the s by d phi is equal to j. Right? Because it's, we differentiate that with respect to phi. So remember, that's j. So in other words, the approximate w, stationary phase approximate w, is equal to this expression where phi has to obey the equation ds by d phi equal to j. Do you know what that is? It's the equation of motion of classical mechanics. You have the action, and you have an external driving force. If you have a theory with an action s of phi, and then you add in the external driving force, if the s was a harmonic oscillator, you would literally call it an external driving force. So you just add the integral j phi, and then you calculate what is the equation of motion. for a system described by an action S with a driving force J phi, well, the equation of motion is this. The S by d phi is equal to J. Okay? But also, look at what we have here. We have that W approximate is equal to the Legendre transform of S. Right? Because it's exactly that. It's the new variable times the old variable minus the old function, where the new variable is given by the derivative of S with respect to phi. Right? So it's exactly the Legendre transform. So the Legendre transform gives us the stationary phase approximation of the integral. And more than that, this is the classical equation of motion. So we see two things. Quantum theory is a Fourier transform. Super hard to do. The lowest order approximation, the approximation where only the stationary phase matters, and no fluctuations around that, where in the entire path integral only one field configuration matters, that is classical mechanics, and it's obtained by the Legendre transform. And literally, you get the solution to your theory by doing the Legendre transform. It's not only in the quantum mechanics, not only in quantum field theory is it true that the Fourier transform gives us a solution. Also in the classical theory. If you can take your action and you can Legendre transform it, if you succeed in that, you have solved the problem. Let me show you why. So we have, as I said, this is just exactly the Legendre transform. And then, so let's ask, what is the approximate W approximate good for? I already anticipated it. Let us define the total action to be the usual action minus this. And remember that if you add this to an action, this is how you describe the coupling of your system to another system with a driving force J. For a harmonic oscillator, that would be exactly, you know, coupling to the elongation of the field. Okay, so we define a new action, which is the old system coupled to a driving force. Then, as a classical action for a classical field phi driven by an external driving force J of x, the equation of motion is obtained by functionally differentiating s with respect to phi and setting that equal to 0. So the s total by d phi equal to 0 is this, the s by d phi minus this differentiated with respect to phi equal to 0. So we get just this equation of motion here. As we said, that's the equation of motion of a classical system driven by an external driving force. Now, to solve the classical equations of motion, what does that amount to? What does it amount to solving such a classical problem? Well, it amounts to calculating for every choice of driving force, J, what the field phi is. So for example, the driving force J could be electric currents, charges and currents. And our field phi could be the electromagnetic field. And then here, all classical, we could say, here are the currents and charges, and we want to know what electromagnetic field do they generate. And then this would be the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations. And what do we want? How? At what point do we say we've solved the problem? Well, we say we've solved the problem if, for any charge and current configuration, we can tell what the field, what the electric and the magnetic field is, right? And the Legendre transform gives you exactly that. So here it says, to solve the classical equations of motion is to find the field phi of x for any given driving J of x. So find the electromagnetic fields given the charges and currents that you put in there. Now this, however, is exactly what W approximation gives you. So this, remember, is the outcome of the Legendre transform. Right? So that's the approximate thing. It's not the full Fourier transform, just the approximate. What does it give you? The W approximation of J is the solution to your problem because differentiated with respect to J. If you differentiate with respect to J, you get back, that's the beginning of another Legendre transform, you get back the original variable. In other words, you obtain phi of x, like the electromagnetic field, as a function of the charges and currents that you put in there. See? If you can perform the Legendre transform, you get W approximation of J. And if you differentiate it once, you get the field. So you can express, using W, you can express the field as a function of J. J is the charges and currents you put in. The field is what you want. So just like in quantum field theory, the Fourier transform gives you the complete solution to the problem, because if you have W of J, its coefficients in the power series of J give you the endpoint correlation functions that describe particle collisions. In a classical theory, you obtain a classical theory by not going all the way and doing the Fourier transform, but just doing the very crude Legendre transform approximation of the stationary phase. And then you get not the W of J, you get the W approximation of J. And if you get it, you have actually solved the classical problem, because you can just plug in your driving forces J and you get the phi out of it. So you get, let's say, for charges and currents, what the electromagnetic field is. All right, that's as far as we got. Let me just switch on the light.